I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Arnold Logan is a first-time novelist with his new book, Springtime in Lawrence Park. He joins me now to discuss the book, which is set in one of Toronto's toniest of neighborhoods, Lawrence Park. I'll get Mr. Logan to tell us about the area and the people therein. I'll also ask him about the characters in this book and what insight he has about the sort of folks who inhabit gated communities, not just in the country's largest city, but elsewhere. Maybe we'll look at those with old money in a new way. I've read a bit of the novel, and it's quite engaging, and but perhaps its author will tell us about what compelled him to write these rich characters. Arnold Logan was born in North Toronto and went to boarding school in England. It's his first novel in the midst of a career in commercial investment. The book is published by Fire and Ash. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program in Toronto today, Arnold Logan. Mr. Logan, good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So we encounter this family at the start of the book. Their surname, the Barnacles, is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah. What year is it when we first meet them?
1975.
And what I found quite interesting is you place in context where this family is, because they live in this wealthy neighborhood. They're well-connected, and we sort of know what's going on in the country. What sort of business is the father in?
Well, the father is currently, like during the life of the book, he's in a kind of government, he's a contractor to the government, the federal government, a kind of a cushy business that he runs with two partners he met in the seminary, where he went because he first wanted to be a priest.
Mm-hmm.
And he found his nature didn't conform to the demands of the church, so he joined these other two reprobates, and they opened a business and took advantage of their political background and were able to secure a very lucrative contract from the government.
So this neighborhood, Lawrence Park, I mean, every big city in this country and elsewhere, you know, have neighborhoods like this. I guess it would be akin to, trying to think, I guess in Vancouver it would be Shaughnessy or Point Grey nowadays.
Right.
Is Lawrence Park a place that you know well?
I know the kind of people. I actually, like, the person who wrote the book, though it is me, literally, mm-hmm. fictively, it's a Dr. Barkas, and I'm editing his papers.
Uh-huh.
And he, like, grew up, you know, he was serving that community, and I, as the editor, was on the outskirts of it. So I know it from, I know the people,
yeah.
But I didn't actually live in that neighborhood or, you know, me as editor was just on the fringes of it.
Yeah. Yeah, the introduction where you talk about who writes the book and your role in editing it, if you will, it was quite funny and quite amusing. In terms of neighborhoods like these, do they look the same, say, 40 years? Do they look the same now as they did, say, 40 years ago, 100 years ago even?
That's a really great, great point, because if you look at the cover of my book, it's all about houses and the changing, people moving in and out and tearing down old homes and putting up more modern structures. It's pretty consistent with what it has been for 100 years, and the best streets haven't changed. But, you know, the very best streets in Lawrence Park, like probably the same in Point Grey, are exactly as they were 100 years ago. But many of the other streets, you know, have changed, though not very much, honestly. They haven't really changed a lot.
I've never been to Toronto, so you'll pardon this question, which I guess shows my ignorance. Bridal Path, because I've heard of that neighborhood. Is that say, near or in Lawrence Park?
Well, that's actually close to where I was born, but Lawrence Park is a totally different neighborhood. Bridal Path is more of the kind of Russian oligarchs right now, you know, are buying up these grand lots and very showy big homes. But Lawrence Park is really the political class more than the nouveau riche.
Yeah, and the people that live in Rosedale, say, because a lot of the people we watch on TV or that we're familiar with in the media, I guess they live in Rosedale, is that right?
Yeah, Rosedale, well, there's quite a bit in the book about Rosedale, which I call Lilyvale,
mm-hmm.
and they're kind of sister neighborhoods, yeah.
So the we've talked about what the neighborhoods look like in terms of the edifices they're in, but in terms of the people, I mean, do they change a lot over the course of the book and the sort of the people that live in these neighborhoods?
The main characters, like Raoul and Tabitha and...
Yeah. No, but I mean, their neighbors, yeah. For example. I mean, you mentioned the Russian oligarchs who moved into the Bridal Path.
Oh, yeah.
Lawrence Park, has that stayed pretty much the same sort of folks?
I think so. They somehow managed to maintain it pretty much with you know, their class of people and people with a long history in the country, and yeah, it hasn't really gone through a huge change. Like, all the waves of immigration
mm-hmm.
haven't changed it.
Well, Raoul and Tabitha, though, in the mid-70s when we first encountered them, they are Catholic. Was that odd, say? I mean, because I generally think of these neighborhoods as being WASPy.
Yeah, well, that's one strand in my book, which they're basically internally and externally in conflict with a lot of the world around them. And part of that is that they feel like a persecuted minority, especially because they're a very traditional brand of Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And the Protestants, they're still kind of, it's like a phantom limb, you know, where someone has a leg amputated and it never goes away. The feeling that it was there, Raoul especially feels that it's, you know, the Protestants could always kind of surround them and they'd have to have a priest hole to kind of hide in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that's more in his mind than it is really a reality in, you know, in the 20th and 21st century there. At least, I mean, I think the early 20th century, there were definitely open conflicts between the Catholics and the Protestants
yeah.
in Toronto.
Yeah, and I guess that comes back from, sort of, comes from, say, wherever they came from in, say, countries in Europe where those conflicts were more pronounced, say. Those tensions, I guess, come back.
Basically, the theme of Sir Thomas More and his battle with Henry VIII
mm-hmm.
Really informs Raoul's prehistoric mind. You know, he's a bit like a reptile and that he's got this primitive brain that's part of him. And that is still living in those days.
Don't most people have that, though?
Yeah, I think everyone does. Like, I'm hoping that, you know, people perceive Raoul and Tabitha and Grady as people that they can relate to, that, you know, that have parts of themselves registered in the past and other parts are in the moment.
Well, we get a sense early on about what boarding school is like, and I found that interesting because I went to public school myself. Did you go to schools like that your whole childhood?
No, I'm actually one of those kids that grew up like a military brat, kind of changing schools every 2 years. So I've been to schools all across the board, really, from boarding school and other private schools and public schools as well in different types of neighborhoods.
And the way that people grow up, they sort of mature, if you will,
yeah.
in the school environment, in a boarding school mindset, is that the same now or in, say, recent years as it would have been, say, 50, 100 years ago?
Well, 100 years ago, you know, the students ruled these boarding schools in England. They could take a teacher they didn't like and bury him in a chest full of sawdust and suffocate them to death. And they could do that to students who they also decided to gang up on. And I don't think that goes on nowadays. Like, when I was there, caning was very common,
mm-hmm.
you know, and which I went through a bit, and other forms of abuse. It's called now abuse, then it was called, you know, something else.
So. Discipline.
Yeah, discipline, yeah.
The character that we see somewhat early on and is throughout the book, I understand, is Marie. That's the daughter, is that right?
Yeah, Marie is a combination of the ineffable and the outrageous. She's kind of a saintly figure who is also a sociopath.
What does she look like?
Well, she's, if you could, like, take a medieval saint and make her look like a beauty queen, I guess that would describe how she looks.
I've only read a couple of chapters, a few chapters, I should say, and there's marriage, there's death, there's sex, there's melodrama, there's satire, too. In terms of what you wanted to send up as the author and say about these people, what was the goal?
Well, I kind of feel that I'm trying to write, you know, within the tradition of literature, which is basically, I think, a lot of the purpose of literature is to expose hypocrisy and the fact that, you know, people do have conflicts within them, and it's often obscured by the masks and the shows that people put on. And I think a lot of writing is designed to kind of bring that to light, what's under the surface.
And there's a lot that's going on within the barnacles and in Marie's past.
Yeah. Marie is definitely, she is the anti-hero of the novel, Marie Barnacle, and then her two brothers, Grady and Declan, are kind of her, make a sandwich out of her, I guess, which she has to cope with growing up, stunted because of all the pressures from her brothers uh-huh. and from the secret that is basically hoarded in their family, and kind of rules the whole life of them, which is the secrets revealed in the beginning of the book, but it haunts the family forever.
Yeah.
And governs how Marie develops.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to think. I mean, and none of us have pasts, or I shouldn't say that. I mean, I don't, pasts that have, you know, such drama or darkness in them. But for a lot of people, a lot of what happens day to day, moving forward, if you will, papers over a lot of what's bad that's happened.
Well, it does and it doesn't. I think it's like a blister that you might put a Band-Aid on, but it's still there.
Yeah.
And it has to either fester and turn into an abscess, or it heals and goes away.
And I guess, I guess in the book, there's a specter over these people. I mean, we're tiptoeing over this because I don't want to give it away to people. So there is something that moves throughout the book that I guess haunts them, if you will.
Right. There is. Well, this is a lot of the book is really about various secrets, and not only from them. There's a few characters like Calistina and Joan and Ernie who have secrets that are revealed as part of the book, and even like one of Marie's boyfriends, Llewellyn, who's a major character, he is not what he seems either, but when you get him alone... When he's alone with Marie, you know, you see a side of him that the world never sees. So They all have secrets that they carry with them. Like, he came from a Scottish and Welsh family that intermarried in Scotland and then emigrated to Canada. And that brought in its train, you know, stuff that they couldn't leave behind in the old country, but they're reliving it in Canada, despite their best intentions.
So, Arnold, this is your first novel. How long did it take to write?
2 years. 2.5 with the editing, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess most of writing is rewriting, isn't it?
It seems that way. That was a shock to me, to tell you the truth. I never anticipated how much I'd have to rewrite.
Yeah, I talk to authors all the time, and I guess that's what turns me off about writing myself. And even though you talk to authors and you think, well, you know, you can do it yourself, and then when they talk about the editing process and what that's like, and especially in a work of fiction which one has created, it can be kind of painful sometimes when you have to change a lot of things or take out a lot of things that you've envisioned.
It's kind of a blessing, though. The funny thing is that I didn't take out a lot.
Uh-huh.
Like, the theme and the structure of the novel, I never kind of broke that apart or changed elements of it. I expanded on some of it, and all the things that I took out was really just redundant language more than anything else, I guess. And I tried to, you know, make it, like, more humorous, because I think, you know, the humor is a key thing to the book.
Yeah, and there is humor throughout the book, and laughed out loud a couple of times. Did you always want to write?
Yeah, well, not when I was in my cradle, but at least since I was 6 years old, I had an inkling that I would want to write.
Yeah, and does that come from, I guess, a love of reading, which you had early on?
A love of reading, and just, I guess, I liked to imagine things.
Yeah. In terms of the genre in which you've written in, is this the sort of writing you like to read?
Yeah, well, I'm heavily invested in the 18th century picaresque novel.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I guess if you wanted to say one book inspired me, in particular, would be like a book called Roxana by Daniel Defoe, who, you know, we know for Robinson Crusoe and Moll Flanders. But when I picked up that book and I read it, it's something about the way they used language back then in prose just kind of gets me excited, I guess, and I wanted to, you know, to follow that path. So, and a lot of those people wrote about women, you know, because women were kind of rising. It was the age of money in England, and women became more independent. So I think that was kind of the beginning of women playing an independent role in literature, and men examining that. I think it's a fascinating thing that a man can actually put himself in the place of a woman and, you know, represent her mind to himself and then project it out through a novel.
Do you think you learn anything about women in the course of writing a book like Springtime in Lawrence Park?
Just that they're a multifaceted mystery. You know, women really are like a diamond, and you can never get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, yeah. Will you continue to write?
Yeah, definitely. I'm definitely, you know, see this as my second career and should be hopefully the one that I always wanted to engage in, but for various reasons I held back until now.
Yeah, yeah. No, it is quite an engaging book, as I said, and an enjoyable one. I can't wait to finish it. When you look at, because we've already talked about women, but when you write a book like this in terms of places that you know or grew up in or nearabouts, does that change the process of memory for you?
Ooh, big question. That's really an interesting question. Wow.
Because and you'll pardon my sort of explaining the question, because you write about a place and a time that, that you obviously have lived in or known about, and I'm curious to know, because I'm 33, so the 70s to me are just as, I guess, well, they're a little more familiar than, say, the 40s would be, but still, you know, unknown, and I can only sort of see it in my mind's eye through things I watch on television or film, say, or in books like yours that I'd be reading. But for you, does that change how you look back after writing a book like this?
Yeah. Actually, you know, now that you mention it, like, I do see myself with a different perception of my own family, you know, in my own years of growing up, and it's tempered it. You know, like all the anger you might, some people carry toward their childhood is actually kind of broken down and washed down the drain a bit through this process.
Do you think that's time, though, or is it the actual process of sitting down and writing a novel?
No, I don't think time would make any difference on its own.
Hmm.
You just become fossilized anger. And when you write the novel, you really do open up worlds of emotion that you hadn't even known were there. And, you know, the key, which I think I try to point out in my novel, which I also got from reading, mm-hmm. is that forgiveness is the first step toward freedom. And only through the writing could I actually even contemplate forgiving people who've hurt me in the past.
You know, when you say it the way you just have, it makes a lot of sense. And it's wise, obviously, but for to get there, it's awfully difficult for a lot of people.
Yeah, I agree. That's a huge challenge, and and there's many roads to find that freedom, you know, the forgiveness, the first step. I think everybody takes it sometime, and hopefully before you're on your deathbed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate that a lot of people can only get to that by that way. You know what I mean? That it takes a deathbed to resolve everything that, well, and sometimes it doesn't resolve itself, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you're ultra stubborn and you cling till the very end to your anger, your disappointment, then I guess you just depart this world with it, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's something that would be really interesting to study, how many people actually die without forgiving themselves and others.
Could be another novel.
Yeah, that's right.
Arnold, it's been a pleasure talking to you today, and as I said, I've enjoyed reading the book as much as I have already, and look forward to finishing it. Continued good luck with the book.
Thanks a lot, Joe. I appreciate it.
The book is called Springtime in Lawrence Park, Fire and Ashes. Its publisher, its author, Arnold Logan, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.